We're finishing up Why Jesus? And we've talked about basically that he is the divine revelation of the invisible God. He is also the revelation of true humanity. He redefines the definition of true humanity, contra what the world offers you. And he paves a way forward to both not just life in the future, but life in the present. He claims to come to give us life in the present. He can give us life to the full in the present. And the question is, do you believe him? And if you do, then where's the disconnect? And so that's where we kind of ended yesterday, asking the question, where's the disconnect? And we started to answer that question by first pulling back and proving that there is a disconnect. So we looked at the poll of the non-Christians, the way they viewed Christians, and the top three ways in which they understand Christians or what Christians are known for: anti-homosexual, judgmental, and hypocritical. So there is a disconnect on some level. The second disconnect comes from the Christian poll, where I showed that in Christian life, and frankly, it doesn't matter if I was in a Christian life class. I've done that at churches several times, and I get the same results. Is I'll put on the list, what are Christians known for? It's usually either really abstract, or it is spiritual disciplines. And then I ask, what is Jesus known for? And what I noticed is that the two lists are different. And that's the problem. The two lists are drastically different. And the question then is, why? Why are they different? And my answer is basically is because we don't know who we are. We've lost our identity. Now, we can ask the question like the purpose-driven life does, what on earth are we here for? Or what on earth am I here for? But until you define the pronoun in that sentence, you won't be able to answer the question. Until you define what the word I means, you will not be able to answer the question, what on earth am I here for? That's the beauty. Whenever you're focusing on identity, on virtue ethics, on becoming something, the more you hammer on identity, the less you even have to address the questions of purpose or actions, because they naturally flow from who you are. And this is why Stuart Briscoe's quote is so potent to me. Stuart Briscoe once said, the more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell them what to do. The more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell someone what to do. And this is so true. This is how I parent my kids. Now, granted, I guess we still have to wait another 9 to 10 years before I can prove whether or not this is somewhat fruitful. But currently, this is how I try to have my kids process the different things that they're doing or not doing. Questions I'm constantly asking them is not just, is what you did wrong? But the question I ask them is, why? Why is that wrong? And the answer, at this point now, I'm almost wondering if it's becoming like Jesus in Sunday school answer. Because now my kids are like, because it's not who we are. But I'm going to use that later when they're a teenager. And when they get ready to leave the house, all I'm going to say to them is, you better remember who you are. Have fun. But remember who you are. Don't ever forget who you are. Because the moment that you do that, or you try to be someone that you're not, is the moment that things start to fall apart. And if they can have a constant concept of, I should be consistently reflecting the reason why I'm frustrated with the way they treated our babysitters on Monday night, they wrote letters and everything last night, we were going over them, and of course Maddox doesn't know how to read or write, so he's having to dictate to Zion what he's going to say, apology-wise. But then they had to come up with a list, 5 each, of why it is that they were wrong, and who did it affect. And so 5 different things. I said, they need to be creative. They can't just be, it was wrong because it was bad. It's like, no, that doesn't count. That's lame. It's wrong because it hurt the people that were around me. That it led people astray. That ultimately it's not who we are. And I even told them, I said, that's not who we are as Christians. And that's not who the Wood family is. That whenever you have this last name at the end of your name, Then you function in a different way. You are. That is a part of your identity. It's reclaiming the force of a proper name. A lot of times in our societies, proper names mean nothing. You know, Shane means nothing. It's just, oh, I like the name, and so I named him that. But in the ancient world, that was just never the case. The ancient world, the names meant something, and it pointed a lot of times to their identity. What did Jacob, what did his name mean? You may remember that from Old Testament history. What does Jacob mean? Deceiver. And that's who he was it not? My gracious, the rest of his life, he's constantly conning someone. As a matter of fact, he's using deception as a means to run from God until he wrestles with God on the banks of the Jabbok. And what happens at the moment where he wrestles all night long with the angel, although I think he thought it was Esau. All night long he wrestles, and then what stops him in his tracks? It wasn't when his hip gets dislocated, he keeps wrestling. What stops him in his tracks? Do you remember the story? The angel says what? What does the angel ask him? So we don't remember the story? He said, "What's your name?" And then he gives him his name and he says, "That's not your name any longer." He's still wrestling at this point. "From here on out, you will be known as Israel." And then immediately, what did Jacob ask? What did he say? "Who are you?" Why? Because names in the ancient world meant something, and you can only change someone's name if you had authority over them. And he thought he was wrestling Esau, which technically Jacob was the one that had the authority over Esau because of the birthright swap when he deceived him out of it. Remember this? It's not an accident, even though whenever Jesus is being born, they say, "And his name will be Emmanuel," which means God with us. Okay, good. I know it's 7 in the morning, but please don't forget what the name Emmanuel means. Please don't forget what that means. It might help you in ministry at some point. Because that's even how Matthew bookends his entire book. "My name is Emmanuel, God with us." And then how does he end it? "And I will be with you to the very end of the age." Names mean something. Why? Because it's an identity that communicates not just your purpose, but also your actions. And therefore, my frustration with my children is not whenever they're just doing bad things. It's whenever they are betraying that they don't know who they are, or they at least don't know who I am. And that's whenever I look at them and I say, no, here's the problem. That's just not who we are. In our family, that's not how we treat people. Why? Because that's not who we are. That's not who we belong to. This making sense? Your actions flow from your identity. It's why Jesus says things along the lines of, you will be able to judge them by their fruit. Why? Well, because the reality is this. Your identity on some level, if I'm using the metaphor, the vine and the branches from John 15. Your identity is the vine. And the branches that produce the fruit, ultimately, that's your works and your purpose and things of that nature. These become corrupted whenever this isn't clearly in focus, whenever this isn't taken care of. Of course, Jesus in that one, he says, "I am the vine." Yes, because he is our identity. See, if I bring this full circle, why is Jesus the vine and we are the branches of him? Because we should be connected to our true identity, which is revealed in the true humanity of Jesus, the divine revelation, the invisible God. He is our identity. And that's why it does make sense on some level whenever you are analyzing what actions are appropriate or inappropriate, whether you're in ministry situations or whether you're even in the dorm, you should be asking the question, how does this reflect my identity? Or how does this flow from my identity? Or how does this reflect Christ? Why? Because ultimately your actions should reflect who you claim to be. And if they don't, then maybe you're not actually who you think you are. That's where it gets a little bit sticky. If you consistently act in a certain manner, and it is antithetical to who you verbally claim to be, then maybe at some point you just need to be honest with yourself and say either, number one, my actions need to change, or number two, I am not who I claim to be. And so then you're back at square one. Who are you then? Who are you connected to? What's your identity? You will reflect who you worship. That's supposed to be the reality. Doesn't mean you'll never fail. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying when you're consistently moving in a pattern that is antithetical to the gospel and you're lowering your head and you continue to do it, at some point you've got to stop and ask the question, who am I? And if you can't say Christ, something needs to give. Either stop claiming to be a Christian or actually be one. Is that making sense? Frankly, honestly, as a minister of the gospel that deals with the accusation of hypocrisy, I'd really appreciate it if people that weren't Christians would stop calling themselves that. It would save me a lot of evangelistic problems. It doesn't do me any favors whenever you claim a name that you're clearly not acting as. So just, how about this? Knock it off, be honest with yourself, and just call yourself what you really are. I'm a liar. Well, at least you know. At least we all know. And there's no deception happening here. Because that's where it just gets frustrating. Okay? Or you can proudly say, I'm a Christian. Awesome. Then join us on the front lines and let's start fighting. Is this making sense? Hypocrisy is a big deal. Because ultimately, even when the accusation of hypocrisy comes, the world is telling us that if you're claiming an identity, it should be reflected in it. And when it's not, they have a problem with it too. Like they're saying, in a sense, the gospel to you. Please, act the way you claim. You should be reflecting the one in which, you know, has the first six letters of your name, Christ, Christian. I mean, the word Christian technically is a diminutive and it means little Christ. That's quite appropriate. I find that to be quite refreshing, actually, even though it was used negatively in the very first time it's used in Antioch. The more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell them what to do. Why? Because what you do is inextricably linked to who you are, and who you are is inextricably linked to who you serve. What you do is inextricably linked to who you are, and who you are is inextricably linked to who you serve. Therefore, your purpose and actions flow from your identity, not the opposite. Not the opposite. Now, some of my Christian life people will start to get a little more comfortable with what we're talking about here. Because now I'm going to analyze what we normally do. And here's where the disconnect comes. Remember, we began this discussion asking, what is the problem? The problem is whenever we're analyzing who, in a sense, what is a Christian known for? Or how to live the Christian life? Or how to do things like biblical justice? Or how to do ministry as a whole? How to be a follower of Jesus? We usually start over here by analyzing our works. And that's what you saw. Either it is so incredibly abstract, or it is listing the spiritual disciplines, our works, our deeds, what we are doing. And that's where we begin. And usually, whenever we begin here, we flow backwards. We look at our works, and then we say, our works define who we are. Whenever it should be the opposite. Who we are defines our works. And what this whole first 3 weeks is arguing for is that the entry point is not what you do. And in a biblical justice class, that's a major pitfall. You could think that this entire class is about what you're doing or not doing for the poor. To which I would respond, then you don't understand biblical justice. It's not about what you're doing or what you're not doing. At least that's not the entry point. The entry point must be the revelation of the Imago Dei. And that is Jesus' works. We have to start here. Why? Because until we understand this clearly, this will make no sense. Until you understand this so crystal clear that you can talk about this and you know this backwards and forwards because you've immersed yourself and saturated yourself in the very life and ministry of Jesus, then you will not do this well. You will do this very destructively. The works of Jesus, we're going to be, and now I'm outlining the rest of the class-ish. Kind of. We're going to be adding some sub-points and things of that nature. But Jesus' works, we split up into His words and His deeds. What He said and what He did. Why? Because that pretty much encompasses all of His works, does it not? He traveled, He healed, He preached, He taught. Therefore, if I look at His words and His deeds, I will know the works of Jesus. Make sense? The words and deeds of Jesus, the works of Jesus, the reason why those are important to study, as a matter of fact, our Gospels, that's all they do. They don't even do a list. They just give us the story of the works of Jesus. That's what they do. They record the things that He said and that He did. Why? For what purpose? To reveal Jesus' identity. And that's a pretty key point in this entire paradigm. Because ultimately, the works of someone should be flowing out of their identity, or if you look at the works of someone, it should reveal their identity. Make sense? Therefore, if I look at the words and the deeds of Jesus, it should ultimately be very crystal clear then who He is. And that is exactly the purpose of the Gospels. They have no other purpose. John 20, 30 through 31, we'll talk about it. He says, I wrote down all these things so that you may know that Jesus is the Christ. So that you may know, I wrote down all these things, so that you may know this is who He is. This is His identity. But frankly, anybody can claim the titles that Jesus claimed. People throughout history have actually claimed to be a Christ figure. Even before Jesus was born, there were several Christs that entered the scene. Granted, they died and didn't resurrect, and so they weren't ultimately validated in that claim. But that's the point. You can even, I mean, there's even been people throughout history that have claimed to be God in the flesh. Even the emperor himself claimed to be God manifest. Antiochus Epiphanes, before the Roman Empire, the word epiphany means God made manifest. He is Antiochus, God in the flesh. Other people have claimed that. Therefore, this and this are important, but they ultimately aren't the end of the story. Because honestly, there have been other people that have even said the stuff he's said, and even done some of the cool miracles he's done too. Now, he did have a couple of doozies, you know, walking on water, calming the storm. Not sure I can find a parallel to that. But healing someone? No, we actually do have evidence of other, and exorcising, Jewish exorcist, was a pretty popular category. So his deeds and his actions point towards an identity, but it is the middle point that brings this all together, that actually makes Jesus separate, unique on some level. And that is Jesus' accomplishments. And we separate Jesus' accomplishments into three categories. I used to only do two, but I was convicted I need a third one. Jesus' accomplishments are the cross, the resurrection, and the ascension. The cross, the resurrection, and the ascension. These separate him from anybody that's made similar claims and done similar things. It puts him in his own category. And ultimately, it defines our very existence. In this, though, what we are going to do is we're going to look at three subcategories, and you don't necessarily need this for your diagram, but here we will look at the Lord's Supper and how that sacrament communicates all of this and then shapes all of what's going to follow. Here we will also look at baptism and why that sacrament summarizes all of this and shapes all that follows. And here, we're actually going to do an in-depth look at the Holy Spirit and how He functions in this entire system. Okay? The accomplishments of Jesus, the identity of Jesus, and the works of Jesus are all driving to this one key area, this one key focus. And that is our identity. Our identity. How is our identity composited? How is it made? How is it developed? The answer is the first three movements. Your identity is shaped and defined by this. This is what gives you your identity. And if at any point you leave off one of these particular areas, your identity becomes skewed. It becomes obscured. It changes fundamentally. So, for example, I have a friend who denies the divinity of Jesus. Guess what? That has categorically changed his entire existence and his identity. It's changed him. Why? Because the moment you alter one of these key areas, it has an impact on you. Not just how you view Jesus. No. What you believe, your theology, does shape your very identity. And therefore, theology is important, which is why we have this entire class. Once then we have these four components in place, once those are very clearly in place, then we can ask the question, then what are our works? But only then. Which is why I really want to point out something very significant about this entire chart. Notice the way in which the arrows flow. And notice the ways in which they don't flow. What do you notice? It starts with Jesus. It moves this way. And what do you notice? What does it not do? It doesn't begin with us and it doesn't flow this way. Why is that important? Because this is what normally happens in our churches. There is a mural at this church I used to preach at. Love that church. It was the I was preaching there for 2 years whenever I was in college here, Harrisonville, Missouri. We drove up there, you know, 2.5 hours every Sunday, 14 of us, and we just, you know, basically, literally, we tripled the size of the church whenever 14 of us started coming from Ozark up there. And then it was a blast. It was honestly some of the most fun time of my entire life. One of the things, though, that was a little disturbing was the mural inside of the lobby. It was a very, you know, tranquil scene. with sheep, grazing on the hills behind this Jesus shepherd image. And have you ever seen one of those pictures where, like, it doesn't matter where you go, the eyes follow you. Everywhere you go, the eyes do. This is the exact opposite. It didn't matter where you stood, Jesus was never looking at you. Like, you could not get him. It was just the way it was painted, but it's like, come on, Jesus. Like, what? Like, he just never was. There was never an eye that was ever pointed at you, not even one. He just never, it's the I can't see you, Jesus picture. But that wasn't what bothered me the most, although theologically that has some major impacts. God can't see what I'm doing. Yeah, he can. Well, his eyes never follow me. Okay, well, anyway, they never even look at me, no matter where I stand. The thing that bothered me most, though, about that mural was the fact that he looked just like me. Just like me. He had blonde hair, blue eyes, and even a little tint of red in his beard. It was weird. And that's what happens a lot of times in our churches whenever we start here, and we usually define Jesus from our works this way. That's what we do. So we transform Jesus in our own image when we start here and move backwards. And all of a sudden, he looks like a white middle-class Republican. And according to Derek Webb, he says, and if you don't learn how to be like him, then you can't follow him. And that's a lot of what you hear inside of our churches. Am I upset that they're choosing that he is white over some other ethnicity? No. Am I upset that they're choosing middle class instead of impoverished or instead of rich? No. Am I upset that they're choosing Republican instead of independent or Democrat? No. What I'm saying is, I don't want him to look like me at all. Like, ultimately, we were created in his image. Remember the first 3 weeks of this class? He's not supposed to be created in ours. But that's what we do. We make a Jesus that looks just like us, that we're so comfortable with, that ultimately we don't need transformation because we've transformed him. And he becomes benign. He becomes self-serving. He becomes very non-threatening. He becomes apolitical. He becomes only spiritual and never physical. He becomes just like us. That's the problem. The reason why the accusation of hypocrisy is so accurate is because we have actually tried in our churches, subconsciously, and yet very intentionally, to create a Jesus that we're comfortable with, and a lot of times we feel most comfortable with ourselves, and yet, it's no wonder we're so dissatisfied in our churches with what we have. Because it's idolatry on some level. It's self-idolatry. I mean, even the heart of the salvation, the idol of salvation, is us. It's self-serving. Even the picture of Jesus that we create is idolatrous because it's us. It's self-serving. And the whole intention of this diagram is to say we need to shatter the way in which we go and define the Bible. The way in which we define the revelation of Christ. The way in which we define true humanity. There are times where, and I try so hard, man, if you know me at all, you know that I do my absolute best to give everyone a fair hearing. And what I mean by that is man, I don't care if you're John Dominic Crossan. I'm going to read your books, and I'm actually going to compliment what deserves to be complimented. And I'm not just going to be like, he's a heretic, why would I read him? Because heretics even get some stuff right. They do. That's the very definition of heresy. It is a lot of truth with a little bit of a tilt, and all of a sudden it becomes completely false. And yet it doesn't mean everything they've said. That's Marcion. Marcion's, the reason why he gets called a heretic, not because everything he said was wrong. It's because he was coming to the same conclusion. There's a problem with the Old Testament. But his answer was, so let's lop it off. The discussion, though, was there isn't a problem with the Old Testament. Their issue was there is, but how do we deal with it? How do we redeem it? The answer was through Christ. Through Christ. The problem, though, what was I talking about? Heresy? Why was I talking about that? Anybody know what I was saying? If I could rewind this recording, I would.
Talking about hypocrisy.
Yeah, man.
You're saying how our churches are, like, the claim of hypocrisy is so pointed because we make Jesus like us.
Yeah. I totally lost my train of thought. I started going back to the Marcion debate, and I lost where I was at in the 21st century. Whole point is this, I don't know. And maybe that's Holy Spirit editing. I don't really know what to do with that. Anyway, the whole point is that we should ultimately to the world be reflecting that which Jesus clearly looks like. In other words, another way of saying this is we should be known what Jesus was known for. And it should be such overwhelming, compelling evidence that the people can't say anything else, but he just loves too much. She just outloves everyone. That you know what? I don't think that Jesus, that they would say this. The non-Christians should say, I don't think Jesus is God. I don't even think he's all that special. But I will say this. The safest and most welcoming and inviting and loving place I've ever stepped foot in is a church. And guess what? We can do that. That's not just idealism. That's with the power of the Holy Spirit and the power of the blood of Jesus through his accomplishments, that's what he created. That's what Acts 2 celebrates. That's what Acts 4 celebrates. That's where people are like, oh, Acts 2, whatever, they're sharing their possessions, no without need. You know, that's borderline communism. No, it's community in Christ. It's not communism. It's community. And you can actually have that. And it looks weird to people that don't get it. My poor neighbor across the street is so confused by the way in which we interact with our shades, Isaac and Maggie Shade, our neighbors, and the DeFazios and the Huckabees. They're confused. First of all, he's like, you guys don't have a fence that divides your backyards? No, why would we? We just have one huge fenced-in backyard. He's like, well, I mean, you know, how do you know which is yours? Well, I mean, we don't really need to ask that question. We just take care of each other. So the other day, he sees me because the shades were gone, and I happened to mow their front lawn because they needed it. This was probably like 3 months ago. But I was getting inside their garage, and he was like, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm going to mow their front lawn. Oh, are they paying you for that? No. Did they ask you to, you know, take care of the lawn or whatever? No, I was just going to do it. Huh. And afterwards, I was, you know, brushing off the grass, the grass cuts or whatever. And he was like, "Well, you're really taking care of them." I was like, "Well, they take care of me too, huh?" It doesn't make sense to him at all. But this is just community. So he's like, "So you guys, I mean, how many of you actually own a lawnmower?" And we're like, "Well, actually, only like one of us or two of us do." So then, what do the other ones do? Well, they borrow them. Oh, so you have to, you know, no, they know the codes to my garage and they just come in and get it. Why? Well, that's just what we do. It's baffling. But you can tell also he's kind of doing one of these. Hey, I want to be a part of that. Absolutely, man. You know, we wouldn't even, you know, well, first belong to Jesus. No, it's like, yeah, come on in. This is what we do. Is this making sense? Where does that come from? This is what I don't like about our evangelistic tactics at times. Sometimes we only make friends with people and the whole time we're like these silent assassins trying to strategically figure out a way to destroy them. Here, let me just give you a better evangelistic tactic. Become more like Jesus. You don't have to strategize at all. It just naturally flows from who you are. Just become like him. I promise you, he wasn't having to sit down and constantly ask the question, now what's my mission statement? What's my vision? What are my three core principles? And how do I then strategically implement them in every facet of my... No, what he did was, I'm just going to live out of the natural outworking of who I am. And that is the revelation of true humanity. What if we did the same? I mean, what if we did the same? What if we stopped spending so much time on figuring out how to do programs and we kept focusing more time on how ultimately to make this who we are and then just lived out of that? And that's why I refuse to talk about even what we're going to be doing until we get through all of this. Because your theology naturally leads to your orthopraxy. But your orthopraxy will destroy your theology if you allow the arrows to go this way. Is this making sense? Are you following what I'm saying here? Everything we've been talking about has been building up to this. He is the revelation of the invisible God. Therefore, it makes sense he is the entry point. And if we look at the way in which he lived, he reveals to us even ourselves and true humanity. And if we live in that direction, ultimately, our mission and our purpose takes care of itself. We will never have to ask, what on earth am I here for? Frankly, that's not even the right place to enter. That's not even the right place to enter in the conversation. What on earth am I here for? right place to enter in the conversation is, who is he? Because it defines who I am. And then I know what to do. And that's how we move through this. Questions, thoughts? Probably have like a minute. Or we're time. Okay, love you guys. See you in the morning.